Hello and welcome to the Shut Up and Sit Down podcast, a podcast about card games today.
What?
Yeah, we talked about what we're going to talk about and we realized abruptly it's no boards. There's no boards in today. Actually, there's a couple of little boards, but they're just like scoring mechanism boards. So they don't count, do they, Tom?
No, they're a sort of liminal space, are they, those ones?
Yeah,
I think we can still classify them as card games, though. It's card games, and the people who love card games this time, baby.
Yeah, I am Ava Foxfort, and I am joined here today by the absolutely wonderful, and I believe just back from travel, Thomas Brewster.
Ava, I am so sleepy. I had a nightmare. I went on holiday. I went to the Czech Republic. I went to the city of Prague. If you're from the Czech Republic, I like where you live. It's a nice place that I enjoyed. I ate so many fermented foods. I think it would be a little bit gauche or gross or yucky to talk about, you know, like my sort of internals on a podcast. But I think you can put the pieces together. You know, it was a lot of ferments and pickles and very cheap beer.
Oh, so you've been pickled and you are full of pickles.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
Pickled and pickled. Truly, that is what I am. And I'm going to try and talk about some card games now. I don't know if I'm in the right state for it, but we'll figure it out on this podcast, won't we? Ava, do you want to tell the people at home what we're going to talk about on this cast?
No, because I think I've forgotten all of the things. Well, we're talking about what you played on your holiday, what we liked playing on a holiday. We're talking about traditional card games. We're talking about trick-taking games. We're talking about a game that I've forgotten the name of. Tom, what's it called?
Yo-Kai Septet.
Good, I'm glad, because I would have definitely said the wrong thing there. And we're talking about a game that Tom is keeping secret from me, what it is, but he says it's a game that I like.
It's going to be a shocking reveal. I'm worried now that it's actually not going to be very exciting, because I think we've talked about it before. You're going to go, oh, is that it? But you can find that out at the end of the podcast. Skip to timestamp if you want to hear Ava's exhausted reaction to my secrecy. Ava, I done did a holiday. We played so many card games while I was on holiday. In fact, this is a hot record. I got back literally 2 hours ago to this flat, and I'm already talking about the games. That is efficient content creation right there.
You're going to pickle us some feelings right now, aren't you?
I am going to. Well, actually, pickling the feelings would mean that I sort of put them in a jar and kind of let them simmer for a while, right? But these are fresh feelings. These are feelings straight hot off the press feelings. Ooh. There's no ferment here. These are raw. I mean, actually, that's probably makes them sound like they're bad opinions. And they could be.
No, but fermenting can be bad. Fermenting can definitely ruin a meal.
An overly stanky opinion.
Let's not keep them in the fridge. Let's not put them in the pickle. Let's listen to them right now and probably cut some of this intro.
I'm kind of interested to see if this first game might actually get accused of being over-pickled, packed with ideas, not simple enough. This game is called Yo-Kai Septet. I heard about it from a few different people who said good things about it. This is a trick-taking card game. And in this game, you are, I think, trying to capture spirits the best. And that's basically all the theme that you get in this one. Very mechanical, very numbersy. In this game, you've got 7 suits, and each suit has a different range of numbers within it. So for example, the green suit just goes from 1 up to 7, whilst blue, which is the highest suit, if you will, goes from 7 all the way up to 13. And each card has a number within that, and it shows you whereabouts it is within that range. So each suit has a range, and each card will be somewhere within it. But the one thing that all of the suits have in common is a shiny number 7 card. Like, literally, it's like a foil card. The 7s in this game are super shiny. So all of them will have a 7 somewhere in their range. And this card is called a boss yokai. And capturing those is what's going to win you the game.
Right, because 7 is the best number, right?
7 is the best number. This game, you know what, actually, let me tell you, Ava, the maths in this game are quite pretty.
Ooh, I do love a pretty maths.
I think I've gone a bit too far down the card games, board games road when I'm describing mathematics as pretty. But, right, it's 7 suits of 7 cards, which is already pleasing. That equals 49, right? And 49 is a yucky number.
Yucky number divides
by 1, 49, and 7. Those are not good numbers for a 3-4 player card game, but you burn a card from the top of the stack, which makes it 48 cards, which divides cleanly between the 3 and 4 player counts this game offers. That's that's quite juicy. Oh, that's quite good, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's like, quite pleasing.
Yeah, I really do love it when a card, when a game has thought about exactly the right number of cards to divide evenly between the different player counts. Like, I know that there's smart maths there, and I rate it. Well done, numbers.
Well done, numbers. You did it again. So as I alluded to, this is a game that is for 3 to 4 players, but I think it's best with 4 players because it is a team game at 4. And at the start of each round, you will pass your opponent a set of 3 cards from your hand, and then you will begin play. You'll play tricks following standard trick-taking rules, right? So you must follow the lead suit, but trumps are going to be randomly determined by that single burned card. The highest trump wins, followed by the highest lead. If you're not familiar with trick-taking games, this might sound slightly ridiculous, but generally speaking, you're playing cards in your hand. The best card wins. The most important thing here, though, is those boss yokai cards that will actually get you towards winning. If you win those, you place them face up in front of you as a score. And if your team collectively catches 4 boss yokai cards between you, you win and you score those cards. They're normally worth about 1 or 2 points apiece, and your opponents will get nothing. You then deal another hand, and it's 1st to 7 total points to win. Here's the thing that makes the game really curious, though, Ava. There are 2 ways that the game can end, right? One is if a team captures a load of those boss cards between them, then they're going to score a load of points. However, if a team takes 7 total tricks between them without getting those 4 boss cards they need to win, they will instead lose the round, get no points, and the other team will score instead, and they'll get the bosses left in their opponent's hands as well as points, which is huge. Because it turns this game into something where you're making really agonizing and risky decisions very quickly, because winning a trick is only ever good if you get scorecards from it, right? Or if potentially you're wrestling the lead suit off someone, but that represents 1 of the 7 possible tricks. Both you and your partner can win for that whole round. It's mean.
Oh, dear.
So I don't think we've cracked this game, right? But that's kind of what compels me about it. One of my friends on holiday with me was a little frustrated by the fact that he thinks it was sort of faffy and overcomplicated. You know, why does it need all these different suits with these different sliding scales? Why does it need, you know, like, there's a card in the green suit. Instead of having a 1, it has an A card, which is actually the best card in the game. And if you play that, you just win any hand. The thing is, right, so this, I think that this game, though, has a load of, like, really interesting nuance to it. Like, the way that you just pass 3 cards to your teammate at the start of a round, you're trying to convey so much information in that pass. And what you can come up with as a team, the way that you can get into that mind, you know, the state that is, like, in the game, the mind, where you're trying to telepathically communicate, oh, boy, I hope that you play that boss card right now, is really fascinating.
Yeah,
it's quite simple to kind of like understand how many cards of each suit have come out, and it's like to ballpark and to gamble roughly how you can take points off your opponents. I think it's really quite something.
Yeah, that's really good. I mean, I would say that like the trick-taking game really is my dad's game, Bridge, and one of the things that I've been surprised I've not seen much of in the like hobby game space is something that adopts that team structure, because playing with a partner, having to not just guess how much you can win, but how much someone else can win, and that sort of stuff. And then putting a shooting the moon kind of thing in it, where sometimes you're going to be able to win everything and upset. And oh, that's really smart. There's really interesting stuff in there. I really want to give this a go now.
Should we talk about Bridge now or later? Because I also played a lot of Bridge on holiday.
Have you actually been playing Bridge?
Yeah, we played a bunch.
That's exciting. One of my like dream features that I'm probably never going to have time for is that my friend Howell has agreed that at some point we're going to attempt to just like join a local Bridge club and see if we can just like bash our heads against Bridge for a couple of months, in the manner of that time that Quinn's tried to learn Street Fighter, only with Bridge and a lot of like old men who are going to just like absolutely demolish me and probably be a bit annoyed at the fact that I even exist.
Yeah, you're probably mostly going to be bashing your head against pensioners more than anything else. But good luck to you. I think that sounds really good. I think I want to get quite good at Bridge now after playing it a bunch on holiday. It feels, again, we're in the similar spot now where, like, talking about delivering a review of Bridge on a podcast segment does seem a little bit ridiculous. But I just wanted to sort of, I did want to talk about it because one of my friends who came on holiday with me was, whenever I bring out a game like The Crew or a game like Yo-Kai Septet or a game like any other number of trick-taking games that have been popular recently in board games, he goes, it's good, but it's no Bridge. You know, and it's similar to the way that people were talking about Crokinole when Quinn was talking about Flick 'em Up and Catacombs. It's good, but it's no Crokinole. And I have now played Bridge and can confirm it's really interesting.
Is it better than The Crew?
Is it better than The Crew? No. I think The Crew is, well, maybe. The Crew is just endlessly enjoyable as a thing to pop out. I think it's so magic, but it's so different to what Bridge is fundamentally. Yeah. And I think that Bridge has some huge hurdles to get over. Like, it is a game that is so steeped in tradition, these quite arcane ways of looking at things that are very, like, run pretty opposite to what most board gamers want. Like, for example, in Bridge, you may be familiar that Bridge is a team game where two players are playing, you know, on the same team to try and score a bunch of points. However, one member on one of the teams is going to be called the dummy, and they literally have nothing to do for that round. Do you know about this?
I didn't know about this. But this is this one of those things where there's normally like quite a lot of different variants of it? So is this one type of Bridge, but Contract Bridge is the one that I'm thinking of?
I have no idea. Quite possibly.
Yeah.
I'm a Bridge beginner. I got taught by my friend in a pub over some pints, and so any rules that I get right or wrong are completely incidental.
Yeah. It's one of those things where when these kind of, I hesitate to call them folk games, but obviously they are, right? Have normally built up so many different ways of playing and different things that you can do with them that you kind of can't play them wrong because there probably is a variant that involves playing it like that. But also everyone will assume that the way that they've been taught is the only possible way you can play it.
Exactly. And I will now fiercely defend this very specific way of Bridge that we played as being the only way that Bridge exists. I'm now da expert and I will wear my badge proudly. But one of the things that happens in the game, so right at the start, what you're going to do is you are going to bid around the table for how many tricks you think you can take with a certain suit as lead. So for example, I might say 7 diamonds, which means I need to win... Oh, sorry, I won't say 7 diamonds. I'll say 1 diamond because the standard bid is 7, I think, or it's 6, and 1 means 1 above 6, which means 7.
Right, because 7 is the best number, right?
Because 7 is the best number. You heard it here first, and you've heard it here again on this podcast. So, you're giving away a lot of information to your partner by saying that. So you say, oh, I can win 7 tricks with diamonds as the lead suit, for example. That means that you probably have a hand that's strong in diamonds. And then therefore your partner might also bid in a sort of similar way that complements you. But the one of the things that's really strange is that whoever wins the bid, whoever says I can take or my team can take this many tricks of this suit, their team member on their turn splays their whole hand out on the table and relieves all autonomy to the other player who's going to essentially play their hand for them for that round.
Oh, okay. Yeah, no, I think I have seen that sort of rule. I don't think that is like the most standard of Bridges, I'll be honest with you, because I'm pretty sure that a lot of it is about actually trying to keep communication later in rounds where you are relying on the other person to know what you're doing. Whereas this is a simpler form because apart from that initial betting, the person who makes the bid that wins gets that full control over it. But also the other players have this extra information, which means that they've got an advantage. Oh, it's sharp design, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the thing that like immediately having this like dummy player, right? Having these strange, like slightly arcane traditional bidding rules that go into the game. These are things, and also like having to remember like the priority of suits and how it actually kind of goes in, I think it goes in reverse alphabetical order and things like that. It's all of this strange stuff. There is a tradition to it, but those traditions definitely feel like frustrating to just hop in to a game. They make you feel like you're going to play this thing that's kind of boggy and old and not very exciting. And then when you start playing it, you realize that it's incredibly lean, incredibly smart, and really, really quite fun. We played so many hands of Bridge over the weekend in various pubs and just had a wonderful time really sort of starting to unpick the strategy of what sounds like this one specific strange variant of Bridge that I've been taught by my friend. But I basically just wanted to, I know I'm no expert expert. I just played it a bunch over this weekend. But I just want to like sort of do a little PSA, Ava, to say that Bridge is really fun. I think people should play it. It's cool. It's not just for granddads anymore.
I have been thinking about this a lot recently, that like there's a frustration in my work in that I think that the most economical purchase you can make in board games is a couple of decks of 52 cards. Mm-hmm. A couple of standard decks of cards is by far the best purchase that you can make if you are looking to maximize the enjoyment that you can get out of thing. Maybe a couple of those old books like Sid Sackson and Rainer Knizia have both done card game books that are well thought of. But yeah, there's just this whole wealth in it. And like whenever you talk, if I'm ever thinking about value for money in terms of games, almost everything I own is dreadful value for money compared to a classic deck of cards. Now, once you've got that, obviously, actually, the rest of the spectrum opens up and you can do a whole load of different things with that. But I do wish that there was a bit more interoperability and a bit more willingness to make games that could be made with more standardized components so that you didn't have to always be buying a huge box. Although then you would lose all of the beautiful art, and there's all sorts of reasons why it is still exciting, and like the texture and physicality of board games is so real. But card games, that standard deck of cards, like, oh my word, you're just pouring through it and you just think people have been playing with these for centuries. Like, it is a big old tradition, and like you find the weird quirks where like different countries have slightly different versions, or like an extra face card, or no, wait, what are they called? An extra court card, or like you look at the tarot deck and how that relates to the standard deck, and like oh cards, I like cards.
Ava, to be honest, I wasn't listening for that entire time because I just fixated on your use of the word interoperability. That's a good word. That is a lean word. That is a critical board game word that you've just deployed in the middle of this podcast. Yeah, we ended up playing a whole like bunch of different card games as well on that holiday with a 52-card deck. We also played Cribbage and we played Gin Rummy, which are both, you know, really fun and interesting games with their own nuances and ideas. And yeah, the shared language of the simplicity of the deck of cards kind of like anchors it in a way that's really quite something. So I won't talk about those other games, and I haven't really talked that much about Bridge other than saying, go and play it. It's good. It's fun. If you have a deck of cards, it takes a very small amount of time to learn. But let's jump into, we've talked about the glory of the 52-card deck. Now let's talk about some other trick-taking games that don't use it.
I mean, you've really battered me down here, to be honest, because like at this point, I am like, everything I'm going to talk about is competing with like the daddy of trick-taking, Bridge Daddy, mm-hmm. Daddy Bridge. Is Daddy Bridge?
Big Daddy Bridge.
A variant? Of Bridge? I don't know. But I wanted to talk. You said that we were going to talk about games to play on holidays. And like at the end of the day, I think like the archetype is a card game that you hang around a table, that you can take to pubs, that you can take to unusual places, that you can know you can rely on in a caravan with a tiny table when it's raining. Presumably less so if you're on holiday in the Czech Republic, which is probably nicer than the holidays I tend to go to, which will be like up a hill over there. It's not entirely true. But yeah, I've been playing quite a few trick-taking games recently and finding them, they're tricky. They're a tricky thing to think about. I know, I think I was almost clever there, but yeah, I don't know. I'm kind of almost don't want to talk about the three games that I'm about to talk about, because for all of them, I'm saying like, oh, this was really nice. But it's got such competition. Like, the competition in trick game taking games is enormous. You've got so many classic standard deck games, as well as a couple of like masterpieces of the genre. And it is really easy to do something new. And it is really hard to do something new that is really, really as exciting as something like The Crew, or mm-hmm. the game that I'm going to wrap up this segment with, that I think is the perfect little box of trick-taking cards for a traditional experience that goes beyond a 52-card deck.
Wow.
So let's talk about the ones that I'm not going to say I'm not hot on them, because I think that we enjoyed each of these. We found them interesting. They were particular and there was things to learn from them. So first of all, there's two games from Allplay, who were previously called BoardGamesTables.com, but have changed to a name that isn't selling tables.
A website.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, I'm not sure that they haven't changed to Allplay.com, actually, now I think about it, but... I'm not
They're now allplay.biz.
Allplay.biz. Sorry, Allplay. You're an interesting little company. I really like how short your rule books are. I really am frustrated that they almost always include a missing rule that means that I don't quite know how to play and end up having to faff around thinking of an answer to a question when otherwise you're making really accessible games in beautiful little boxes, which are really interesting. Now, two of these games are part of a new series that they're making called Trick Taking. They're releasing a line of trick takers. And I played first Ghosts of Christmas, which
I've played Ghosts of Christmas.
Yeah, I thought you might. I thought we might have talked about it before, or someone might have talked about it before on the podcast. Ghosts of Christmas is a fairly standard trick taking game based around the Scrooge story. The Christmas Carol, if you will, where you're playing into these three different time periods, the past, the present, and the future, and you can jump between them to put cards into them. You'll only be able to play one card on each of the zones, but you play all three tricks of the round at once. This is kind of cool. And also, I think it's really poor choice of theme because that's not what the ghosts are doing. They're showing you things from the past and not time traveling. And this would actually be quite a good time traveling story where you're bouncing between different things. And
I was going to say, like, famously, the ghosts of past, present, and future all turn up at the same time and do their whole thing simultaneously in the Christmas Carol?
I don't know why. And it looks, I guess, you know, there's not a lot of Christmas themed games. So if someone's looking for that, then this is an answer. But I think that it is interesting and you are asking weird questions, but fundamentally, those questions are just asking you to keep more things in your head. Like, a lot of this is basically about making the card counting of these sort of games a little bit harder. But it's still just that. Because really, you can work out what people are doing, and I can't work out what people are doing, so maybe I'm just too not clever enough for this sort of game. But
I thought I was too stupid for this game as well.
Yeah.
And I think that's almost all I remember from it. But I actually don't think it's too complicated, especially compared to some of the other trick-taking games that I've played recently. But I also kind of left it with a feeling of, like, this is good, but I would rather play any number of sort of like classic card games, which is sad. But I think that there's something really interesting about that, like that knock-on causal effect of the lead changing through the three different time periods, but it doesn't like glue together into something that was like tremendously satisfying. I never pulled off something that I felt was truly intentional in that game at times. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, and I kind of got a couple of things in there where I felt like I had a little bit of control over it, but they also, it just felt like I probably still got a bit lucky or had seen the mistakes that other people had made and so had a bit of an option. And yeah, but it's nice. There's some nice ideas in there and it's a very sweet production. So like, I wouldn't say don't buy this unless you only want to have like one trick taking game in your collection, which is something that you might want to do, but it's interesting.
Ava, do you know what this game used to be called?
I know it's something good.
Time Palatrix. Come on. Why is it called Ghosts of Christmas? It used to be called Time Palatrix. Yeah, that's ridiculous.
That's a poor choice.
Let's talk about your next game.
Next game is Nine Lives, another all-play one that is like really quite cute in some ways. You've got these cats. You've got these cats that you bid, and you've got I believe it's called the Prediction Rug. Which is a tiny scoreboard in the middle in which you're saying how many tricks you think you're going to be able to win this round. But there's four spots on it and it loops round. So over up to nine tricks, although actually technically it could be more for reasons that I'll get to in a second. But you're putting these cats either sideways so that they cover two numbers, which means that you'll get 2 points for either of those numbers coming up. Or you put them like perpendicular to the board so that they're only pointing at one number, which means that you'll get 4 points if you win a round. You're trying to get up to 9 points over a series of rounds. And the other, this little backing mechanism is really, really small and minor and actually became a bit of a clog because we got to a final round and we were like, oh, do you know what? There's literally no way of anyone winning this apart from both of us ganging up to make sure that that person loses. And then that will just make this person win in a way that's really unsatisfying. But we won't go into that. Because the other thing that is interesting here is, well, there's two things. Firstly, this is the first trick-taking game I've ever played, which shows you the suit of the card on the backs of the cards.
Huh.
So when you're making your guesses, you know what other suits are represented in each other's hands. So you have this extra knowledge about which, what things might be about to lead, what things you can play safely, and stuff like that. I kind of wish it was in a slightly different game because the next bit doesn't necessarily mesh with that as well, which is that when you win a trick in this game, you have to take one of the cards you beat into your hand.
Ooh.
Right?
This is weird.
Yeah, no, exactly. It's weird, right? This is spicy. There's something going on here that is cool. Because, yeah, you will... By winning a trick, by losing a trick, you may be feeding something into another player's hand. And if you can force that or taking it into yours, and the round only ends once someone has completely run out of cards, which could be longer than the nine tricks that you would expect in a nine-handed, a nine-card hand, right? So this is cool. You've got this like additional control and an additional ability to manipulate what cards other people have got. But it's also kind of taken the teeth out of that by letting you see the backs of it. Now, I will say that one of the things I don't like about trick-taking games is whenever I'm playing with new people and I have to keep on saying, yeah, you can only play that if you haven't got any of X. Because you're not allowed to break suit, right? Like it's a simple enough rule, but people, when they're playing for the first time, struggle to get their heads around it. And there's no good way for that to end up, because either they haven't just accidentally cheated and it sounds like you're accusing them of cheating and thinking that they don't understand, or they have and now they feel bad because they've just been caught fake cheating, and you know that they aren't, you know, it's just an accident and you don't know. This gets you out of that because it means that you can actually see on their cards. Now, is that enough to recommend this game as a good intro to trick taking? Sure, it's fine. I don't know, there's a lot of really, really sharp ideas in them. I don't think they gel enough to make it be a brilliant trick taker that I want to run out and recommend, but it has got cats. It has got
people like them.
Yeah, it has got cats and people like cats. It's got the worst number fonts that I've ever seen in a game.
Oh, that's bad.
Yeah,
that's very bad.
But it's also got a prediction rug.
Yeah, the prediction rug does sound really good. What's up with the number fonts? What's wrong with them?
They're kind of like modernist
gooey?
Computer. No, they're a bit slabby.
Bit slabby,
but with like strong indentations. So like there's one number that's like actually hard to identify, which is obviously...
Splixty. Splixty. That's the one that's...
Splixty.
You got confused by the Splixty, yeah. That's a confusing number. Final game
is... actually like so simple to explain in this context that that's really cool. The final game is Bug Council of Backyardia, a game that I had pressed into my hands by Patrick Engro, the designer at PAX Unplugged. I think it's really pretty and I think it's really smart, and I would like to play it more before I told you whether it was like actually like really interesting or not. And it's kind of a bit punished by the fact that were you there when we played Boast or Nothing with Kellen?
Yes, I was. And it was the best. It was just the best.
Just a quick aside to say Boast or Nothing is not available widely. But if you can find an imported copy of it, I think it is the ultimate starter trick-taking game. It is very, very simple, very, very quick. And it's just got this key thing where at the end of the round, you've got this little stack that is the priority of the suits and which will trump which. And whenever a card wins, it's its little token goes to the bottom of that stack, and then you play the next round. It's got the simplest scoring mechanism I've ever seen in the game. It's very low card count, and it is very, very, very good. Now, Bug Council of Backyardia does this same thing of making that when a card wins, it will reduce the power of that card's ability in the game. And the really interesting thing is the way that it does this is by playing a little game of Mancala, or like a kind of rondel drop mechanism on the board. So this one does have a board. Oh, but it's made up of jigsaw pieces, and really it could just be a load of circles. And it's really pretty. And it's mostly a scoring mechanism, so I think it's fine.
We'll let it pass. It's a disguised board.
It's a disguised board. Yeah, it's actually not a board, but it looks like a board to try and trick you into thinking something.
Stealth board.
So whenever a card wins, you pick up all of the cubes that are in its space around the council table, which I think is what the thing is, and you drop them in around the table into all of the other buckets so that other suits will get more powerful as a result of that. Now this is manipulable. Like, if there's a thing that's only got two and you can make that win, then that means that you know which two it's going to go into, and you know which one is going to be more powerful next. This is eminently trappable. With a group of people, it's quite easy to spot that someone's going for something and then hope that they've got none of those, so if we can make that powerful, we know that they're going to do that, but then maybe that's also what they've got left over after they've not broken suit. I think this is actually quite good. However, I only played it with five players, and at five players, it became a bit perfunctory. So I really want to try it at a smaller player count just to see if you've got more control, because I think that it's a really lovely idea and a really nice presentation. The art is a little bit... I think some people we played with really didn't like the art and some people really did. But there's a lot of very nice touches. I think the art on the board that isn't a board is like gorgeous, like almost like art deco-ness. And the background images and all of the card are great, and everything is really clear and well laid out. So like, there's a lot of good stuff to talk about here, but Ghost or Nothing is tighter, and I worry that this might be a bit too chaotic to actually be predictable. I think it was really fun though, and I really, really don't want to bring it on here and complain about it, because yeah, it's a nice little indie thing that I got handed that I think I'd like more people to take a look at, because I think that it is very, very fun and cute.
I'll say that it certainly doesn't look like, you know, a sort of a starter trick-taking game. There's plenty of bells and whistles just looking at this to sort of be perplexed by. But I think that it does look really interesting. I'm keen to give it a go, Ava.
Yeah.
This has got me similarly excited as to when you talked about, what was that? Dranic Nitsio Dice game. Gang of Dice.
Gang of Dice, yeah. Oh, and that's in a box that I've got to send down to Matt, but I don't have his address, so I can't send it to him. That is three all right trick-taking game, but I kind of want to actually answer the question that I would say of, like, if you were taking a boxed game on holiday with you, what should you take? And I still want to be talking about trick-taking games, and there's only one thing that I want to talk about when I want to talk about this, and that's not true, because obviously normally I'd be saying The Crew, but here we're talking about hanging around with your friends and just having like a traditional time, being able to welcome people in who you meet and just being ready to go straight away, and that is Skull King. I love Skull King.
Okay.
Skull King is very good.
What is it?
It's a pirate-themed trick-taking game that makes a load of simple wrinkles to the game. I think most of these do appear in some traditional trick-taking games. So I don't think this is like hugely innovative, but it is nicely packaged. And it also insists, and you don't have to do this, but I suggest you do, at the beginning of every round, you bid on how many tricks you think you can win by putting your hand into the middle and going, yo, ho, ho. And on the second ho, sticking out a number of fingers to indicate how much you're going to bid, at which point everyone starts wailing because, like, you're playing a hand where there's only two cards and everyone said that they're going to win two, and you know that nobody's going to be happy. So
that's good. That's sharp straight away.
That's sharp straight
That'll
away.
That'll get right. people slowly gravitating towards you as they pondering why people are chanting yo-ho-ho and then screaming in a corner of the hostel. Lovely.
Which is exactly what you want, right? You want people to notice that something's going on and you want it to be a little bit silly, but also be followed by pensive thought as people actually play the game. Now, now this adds some extra cards to a standard deck. So you've got suit cards, but you've also got a few extra tricky ones. You have an escape card or two, which is a card that will mean that you are guaranteed to lose that round. You have a mermaid card that is a little bit stronger. You have a card that you can decide to play as a escape if you want it to, or it plays as quite a strong card, so you've kind of got a versatile card that can switch one way or the other. And you have the Skull King himself. Now, the Skull King is powerful and will make a trick be worth more points to whoever can win it. However, the only way to beat the Skull King, absolutely the only way to beat the Skull King, is to play the mermaid who lures the Skull King and defeats them. And so you've got cards that are weaker than each other and stronger than each other in different scenarios, but these are all at the top end of the deck, because there's also just standard pirates, which are above the suits and will trump any of the standard suits. And there's also a trump within the four standard suits. So, like, there's enough wrinkles on what can win at what times that you never know quite what is going to happen. You never know when someone's got something particularly exciting. Finally, and this is the best thing, like, the point scoring is a little bit brutal for whether you get your number. There's an option to bid nothing, which will multiply the amount of scores you win if you succeed it. So, like, that's really powerful, particularly in the late game, because Tom, mm-hmm. This game has the perfect arc, particularly for a trick-taking game, because it means that you can guarantee that you can teach this game as you go, and the first few rounds don't really matter, because in round one, you play a one-card hand. In round two, you play a two-card hand. In round three, you play a three-card hand. In round four, you play a four-card hand. All of the time, the complication of the game is increasing until this final hand of 10 cards each, where everyone is staring at each other and wondering what's going to happen. And it's like the ideal trick-taking game. Some people are behind, but they're like desperately trying to shoot the moon and bid nothing, knowing that it'll get them like 10 times 10 points. And it's really good. It's really simple.
It does sound good.
It's really stupid. It's really like fundamental basics of trick-taking, but with maximum drama, a soupçon of silliness, and an escalating journey that means that you get beefs and rivalries and time for people to learn how to play before they've done so badly that they can't win.
I like it. It sounds good. It sounds fun. I might have to get myself a copy.
Of this. I think there's a new edition out now that I saw at Aircon, where I was at the weekend. I saw that there was a more recent edition than the old tattered German box that I've had for a very long time. And like, it's one of those tiny boxes that's only just got enough room for the cards and doesn't quite glue together, and because it's been out, I have to have an elastic band around it and everything, so I quite want a new copy at some point, but they didn't have any left because it sold out.
I'm going to jump straight from that observation about not quite fitting all of the cards inside of the box to the final game, which I'm only just going to talk about very briefly at the end of the podcast. That's the hidden secret game, Ava, that I wanted to talk to you about, because I've come round to it. Fully been sunk in the deep end of innovation.
Yes!
But not all the cards fit in the box.
Tom.
Yes?
I really like innovation, and I like you now.
Yeah, it's really good, isn't it?
I was upset about the fact I'd had to not like you because you didn't like it, even though it's like an intensely unlikable game because it's very weird and specific.
It's so unlikable. It's so weird and specific. It's so irritating, but it's just delightful though, isn't it? I've fully come round on it.
I'm still really bitter about the first time that I played it and someone said to me, oh, it's just posh flux.
Because it's true?
Because it's true and I can't argue with it, but like, it's really good anyway.
I think I was similarly very glib about innovation when I played it with you most recently, and I won very easily despite being a complete beginner, and thought, well, that's just a bit silly, isn't it? Ava's played this game hundreds of times and I've just steamrolled everyone in that first game of innovation. But I think that you're right that over many games, you can really start to key into some really quite complicated and gooey strategy and theme. So what I'll do is I'm just going to give this the briefest. We've already gone a little long on this podcast. So this is just the briefest of most positive recommendations to go out and get yourself a copy of Innovation. I've fully come around on it. Essentially, what this is a 2-4 player card game where you are representing a civilization growing in front of you. There are 10 decks of cards, each deck showing the different innovations of each age of the game, from prehistory all the way to like postmodern or something at the other end. Players on their turn are going to draw cards from these decks and play them most simply in front of them as innovations that now exist in their empire. So, for example, you could draw a card like canal building and you play it in front of you. Now you have access to canal building. By activating that card, you get a specific effect. Every single card is completely unique that will change the way that your civilization works. And you know what? I'm actually going to completely end talking about the game there rather than getting into the gooey, you know, the strategy of it or the complexities of the rules, like how what the main action in the game is called dogma, and that puts people off almost instantly, and how the very quite the fiddly scoring works. There's a difference between points and achievements. You need one to get the other, but only one of them counts for winning the game unless you go to the 11th age, which doesn't exist. There's
or like
of
any
strange...
of the random cards in the late era that mean that you do end up having to pay attention to scoring, but sometimes you want to score low and sometimes you want to score high depending on what's going on. Oh my God, Tom, I love it.
Yeah, or some of the cards in the late age that just mean that you will win the game, or those weird achievements that you can get early on, but then if you don't get them early on, you get them later by doing these things that everyone forgets about. There's so much weird stuff that makes this game super arcane and complicated and frustrating to play, but I just think that this time that I played it, once all of that melted away and I understood the sort of the systems at their core, I was just so delighted by how thematic Innovation is with such a simple set of cards in front of you. Like, the most obvious example to me in our games was colonialism. It's a card that exists. You play colonialism, now colonialism is part of your civilization. What colonialism does, and I'm going to sort of butcher my explanation of this, is if you have more money, or no, not if you have more money, if you have more factories, which is one of the symbols, if you have more industriousness than the other players around the table, and I'm doing that in industriousness in big air quotes there, what you do is you scour their board for cards that have money on them. You take those cards and you tuck them under the rest of your civilization. So you're amassing just hordes of other people's wealth. And it is like, with that very simple interaction on that card, you are telling a story. And when a player is going ham on colonialism, they instantly become the villain. Because not only because, you know, colonialism is bad outside of the game, but it's horrible within it. It's a perfect mesh of mechanics and theme.
Yeah.
And then from there, just so much nuance that exists once you just know, even just a few cards out of those first few sets, if you know that something is in there, like for example, in a recent game, I had a bunch of cards that had a load of money symbols on them, and I was just digging for a card called the Pirate Code, which deeply benefits a player who's accumulated a load of wealth because they can go and, you know, sail around the rest of the civilizations and pilfer their stuff. As soon as you know that there are these tentpole cards in the various decks, you can build so much strategy. That's just wrong.
No, it's right.
So much strategy from such simple cards. I just think it's great. I'm fully converted. Kellen from Board Game Barrage perennially puts Innovation at number one on his end of year lists. And I'm here to say, I agree. I don't agree. It's not going to go number one on my list, but it's going to be pretty high. A really great game as well to just play with the same person over and over again.
Yeah, and this is the thing that I want to talk about, because I think I will have mentioned this before, but like since early lockdown, since one of the first lockdowns, I have been playing games against a Canadian guy called Jeremy, who I adore. And we have played hundreds and hundreds of games of Innovation at this point. We just always just start up a new one online, asynchronous. We occasionally, like, one of us gets busier and it falls apart for a month or so, but then it comes back and it's just a delight to start exploring that stuff again. Now, we've recently been playing... Board Game Arena has started adding the expansions slowly. So we've been trying out some of the expansions, and oh my word, they are bananas. but like, oh, honestly, I can't think of another game I have played this much. And the fact that it is still one of the games that I am most excited to try and the most amused by how different games can be sometimes, by how many different stories you can tell. And how, like, me and Jeremy occasionally will delve into things where we try and, like, analyze what our civilization is and what it's doing to the other player and how that is interacting and how that is working. And, like, what does it mean when someone uses the wheel to defeat nuclear fission, right? Like, there's a conceptual weirdness here that is like, I think that a couple of Karl Chudik games, who is my favorite designer, so I do bang on a bit, are almost satires of like classic genres of board games. And like one of them, like Impulses, is one that's like a Twilight Imperium condensed into the smallest thing possible. This is a civilization game built into the smallest, tiniest box you could possibly imagine squeezing a civilization game into it. And it is more historically accurate, more interesting, more weird, more unpredictable, and more clever than any Civ game I have ever played.
Yeah, I can 100% agree. And also, I think that it also comes with a level of... one thing that I think is... It also comes with this level of inscrutability that's kind of hilarious when people come and watch you play a game of innovation. Like, so predominantly, I was on holiday with a few people, but predominantly this was just for me and one of my other friends. We are the innovation heads of the group, and it is us who bash our heads against this puzzle. And everyone else was sort of looking at it and just mildly chuckling when someone says, I'm going to, you know, for example, I'm going to play the wheel and draw two cards from the postmodern deck. Or something like that, right? It makes you say a lot of very goofy stuff, which, you know, I that's what I think is joyous about it, is that it's a really quite, it is literally in the most beige box imaginable. It is dry on the surface. There is so much text and there is so much analysis that can go on, but it has a real playfulness to it that I think is really quite special.
Yeah.
You're right, yes. Yeah, satirical almost can hit the nail on the head there.
Yeah. And I think, like, it is worth noting that I don't know if I've ever met anyone who loved this game on their first go of it, but I do know that anyone who took the time and patience to learn to play this has ended up finding it like properly delightful. And like, that's hard because that's sounding like when someone recommends you play like watch like three seasons of a show because it gets really good towards the end, which I'm guilty of doing quite a lot of times. But there is a lot of things that will get in the way of you enjoying this. And if you don't like specific card interactions, weird, like almost take that-y things that you can predict, but also you can't, and you can defend against, but also you might not be able to. Like, there is a lot of things that could put you off about this game. I still think it is right up there as one of the best card games in existence. I wouldn't take it on a holiday unless I was going on holiday with someone else who loved innovation.
I was lucky enough to be blessed with someone who was skeptical of innovation, but willing to be enthralled by it. Oh, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's the best kind of person to go on holiday with, right?
Yeah. Shout out to Jamie. Shout out to Jeremy. Shout out to Innovation.
Jeremy. Yeah, always play it with a guy whose names begin with a J.
With J.
Jack. Jack was the one who taught me.
Oh yeah. That is all we've got time for on this episode of the Shut Up and Sit Down podcast. A little bit of a loosey-goosey one. A little bit of a rambler. A little bit of a bumbler. Because I'm really sleepy now. I thought I was sleepy before the podcast, but my goodness, my 4 hours of sleep is really catching up to me, and I've still got to edit, so maybe the edit is going to be loopy as well. Ava, what are you doing for the rest of the day?
I think I've got like a training to deliver, and I'm quite poorly.
My goodness. Oh, well, best of luck.
No, I'm all right. I'm on the mend, and it's nothing too bad. Oh, seven's the best number, though.
Seven's a great number.
I don't know if it's true, because I refuse to fact check this, because it's just one of those things that I love so much that I decide to believe it's real anyway. But my understanding is that Peter Gabriel released a greatest hits album that was just track number seven from all of his albums.
Is that true? You know,
and that's why,
check that out.
That's why number seven is the best number, because probably apocryphal Peter Gabriel told me so. did we review seven games?
One, we reviewed Yoko Septet Bridge. Four trick-taking games. Oh my God.